Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the nation's public health panjan drums made their way up to Capitol Hill yesterday. The Fauci's and the Walensky's. And I'll tell you what, when you've lost Susan Collins, you've really lost control. I hate to break it to the Center for Control, but that's seemed to be what happened yesterday. Susan Collins, who does a spot-on impersonation of Dana Carvey doing Katherine Hepburn, had this to say to Rochelle Walensky, CDC director.
So here we have unnecessary barriers to reopening schools, exaggerating the risks of outdoor transmission, and unworkable restrictions on summer camps. Why does this matter? It matters because it undermines public confidence in your recommendations, in the recommendations that do make sense, in the recommendations that Americans should be following. I'd like you to respond to why the CDC is not following the standard procedures, why it's having offline secret negotiations with one stakeholder that was revealed only through reporting and a FOIA request, why it is exaggerating outdoor transmission. We know that masks make a big difference indoors. They don't outdoors.
Thank you for that question. Maybe if I could take each of your examples one by one. First, the school guidance. As a matter of practice, the CDC engages with stakeholders, with consumers who take our guidance, who use our guidance before it is finalized so we can understand whether it addresses their needs.
Bold jive.
Yeah, that's so.
Give me a break.
It's not even worth listening to the rest of it because she was dishonest about their collaboration with the American Federation for Teachers on the guidance with respect to opening schools. So she lied about that, and Collins is right about the exaggerations. Remember, Rochelle Walensky, CDC director, Dr. Walensky, less than 10% of documented transmission in many studies has occurred outdoors. We also know there's almost a 20-fold increased risk of transmission in the indoor setting rather than the outdoor setting. Less than 10%.
No, it's 0.1% maybe at most.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they knew that. We knew that. And they're spreading lies. They're in with the unions. They're in bed with them. And they're just, you know, and they even, you don't have to be 6 feet apart in school. It's 3 feet.
The,
well that's why a lot of schools are reopening.
You don't have to be any feet apart. So they attempt to suggest that, yeah, we know this and we know that. And they get the orders of magnitude off because they want you to believe that it is still something that,
there's nothing there.
There's still something to be concerned about here, and there's still something to be concerned about there so that they can continue to micromanage all aspects of life, whether it occurs indoors or outdoors. It's dishonest. As is the exaggerating the evidence of transmission outdoors, exaggerating the danger to kids, particularly against the backdrop now of the green lighting of the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds. On a statistical basis, twice as many minors will die of drowning than COVID. Two times as many minors will die of drowning than COVID. A survey by Gallup and Franklin Templeton found that people think 8% of U.S. COVID deaths have been to people under 25. The actual answer is 0.1%.
0.1%. People wake up.
You're off by 80x. People are off by 80x in terms of the threat that COVID poses to people under 25, the threat it poses to minors. And this is against the backdrop of this uninterrupted stampede towards whatever pronouncements the CDC makes on these topics. It's just stunning.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Our kids have more, you know, dangerous driving in a car than they do catching COVID or even dying from COVID.
Well, of course, so the five times as many minors will die in a car accident.
Yeah. Three times as many will drown.
I wish it twice as many. I just wish that there would be, you know, the questions. It's a leading question. What Susan Collins said is right, and she's not the best person to do what I'm about to suggest. I just wish people would point blank. Rand Paul did it with Fauci on another matter with respect to, you know, the relationship between National Institutes for Health and the Wuhan Virology Lab. Okay. But just in terms of, like,
just stick it between their eyes.
Grab the television camera and shake it and just talk to the American people and relay the same data that we have and that we relay here. It is incontrovertible. But they dance around it, as you heard Walensky dance around their relationship with the American Federation of Teachers. They dance around these statistics. They sort of concede that you're directionally correct, but give generic offerings of we still have to be good. There's still daily cases. There's too high. We still have to do this. We still have to do that.
We still have to wash your hands.
Even Susan Collins saying we know that masks indoors are very effective. No, we don't.
No.
No, we don't. That's not true. At least there's no
You've been
overwhelming
told that.
Medical evidence to support that claim. There isn't.
The biggest maskers I know are the ones who got COVID.
Frank and Arlington Heights are in. I got a call screener problem. Can you bring up Frank in Arlington Heights?
Hey, good morning. You know what I would like to know is when are these people going to be held accountable for all these lies, all this disruption of our lives?
They're not going to
all
be.
These deaths. Well, I know, but it we don't live in a republic. We don't live in a place where any justice occurs. I mean, these people are, you know, some of them are just absolutely despicable, and nothing is ever going to happen to any of them, anything. CDC is just going to continue on. They're going to continue with funding the things like the Wuhan lab and the gain of function stuff. Man, this stuff is criminal. I mean, why is anybody held accountable? That's what Rand Paul should be asking. Where's the Justice Department in some of this stuff?
Thanks for the call, Frank. Well, so right on cue. So Rand Paul and Tony Fauci on gain of function research funding and the collaboration. The names are less important. The overlay here is NIH, NIAID funding of the Wuhan Virology Lab. And the back and forth, the argument they have was sort of a definitional one of whether or not there was technical funding for gain of function research when it came to viruses and China's interest in weaponizing viruses. This was that exchange.
You're fooling with Mother Nature here. You're allowing superviruses to be created with a 15% mortality. It's very dangerous. I think it was a huge mistake to share this with China, and it's a huge mistake to allow this to continue in the United States. And we should be very careful to investigate where this virus came from.
I fully agree that you should investigate where the virus came from. But again, we have not funded gain-of-function research on this virus in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, no matter how many times
you're parsing
you say
words.
There
was research done with Dr. Shi and Dr. Barrick. They have collaborated on gain-of-function research where they enhanced the SARS virus to infect human airway cells, and they did it by merging a new spike protein on it. That is gain-of-function. That was joint research between the Wuhan Institute and Dr. Barrick. You can't deny it.
But he did. That's all they have to do, because who else will hold them to account other than 5 minutes of questioning from one U.S. senator? Jim in Crown Point.
You know how many people have died from the vaccine? 4,000. That's children, elderly, middle aged.
Yeah.
That's
debatable.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's not. It's a fact. Look it up. Look it up.
No. Okay. Thanks for the call, Jim. It's debatable because we're not going to do on the vaccine what they did to us with COVID deaths. We're not going to confuse causation with correlation. And I understand the concerns, and we'll get to vaccines this momentarily, but we're not going to do that. Keith in
Oosberg.
Oosberg, hey, Wisconsin.
Oosberg. Good morning, Oosberg.
Oosberg, Wisconsin. Good morning, guys. How are we doing this morning?
Good.
All these germaphobes at the CDC, when they look at us, all they do is see germs and viruses and stuff of that nature. So there's no healing for them. All they see is virus, virus, virus.
And this is their Super Bowl.
Thanks for the call, Keith. Yeah, it is a bit of a myopic one-trick pony, if there is such a thing, isn't it?
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Only the young can say there'll be another day. Well, the young can't say anything. They're indoors. They're locked up. Still, for the most part. I want to make one more comment about that exchange between Rand Paul and Tony Fauci yesterday on the Hill, talking about gain of function research funding and the relationship between NIH and the Wuhan Virology Lab. We talked about this on Monday with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation, but in the context of that exchange where there was a sort of argument about definition, and Rand Paul was pretty strident and I think pretty compelling too, that there was this unholy relationship between NIH and the Chinese communists vis-a-vis the Wuhan Virology Lab. Two pieces of information. The unnatural origin of SARS and new species of man-made viruses as genetic bioweapons. This was a paper that was obtained by the Australian outlet for Sky News. And this paper was released back 2016, 5 years before the start of COVID. It describes SARS coronavirus as a new era of genetic weapons that can be artificially manipulated into an emerging human disease virus, then weaponized and unleashed in a way never seen before. Peter Jennings, no relation, the executive director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, told the Australian news outlet that it's as close to a smoking gun as we've got. I think it's significant because it clearly shows that Chinese scientists were thinking about military application for different strains of the coronavirus and thinking about how it could be deployed. So that's one bit of information. The other bit is this former New York Times reporter who published in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Nicholas Wade is his name, and he makes the case that it is more likely than not that the virus originated in the virology lab in Wuhan. And he specifically points to the director there and the research that she was doing, consistent with what Rand Paul was saying. Okay. So some real questions that were raised, we don't have answers to. And Tony Fauci's cover for it was, of course, I mean, what else can he say? Of course we should investigate the source of the virus. Of course, I completely agree with transparency in that direction, so long as transparency doesn't implicate me in the other direction. And so he sort of redefines what that relationship was and what state-funded scientists from America were doing with state communist-funded scientists in China. And so if that's what the Chinese communists are doing, then what about these vaccines? There's a very good talk by Dr. Alan Moy, who's the research director at the John Paul II Institute in Iowa. He is a pulmonologist, Creighton Medical School. He gave a talk on April 16th to Catholic Citizens of Illinois. It's online. I suggest watching the whole thing. But just sort of a few primers on vaccines. And one big misunderstanding, I think he would say, that people have about vaccines and what they do and what they don't do. First of all, there's three types of immunity. And thus, vaccines can offer different levels of immunity. He goes through it. And listen to what he says about transmission.
So there are three basic types of immunity that someone has to adapt. One is a respiratory mucosal immunity. So as it enters the respiratory tract, one has to develop a localized immunity towards that virus. The other is a what's called a humoral immunity, that one has to adapt an antibody to that virus. And that is the type of marker that pharmaceutical companies typically use when they're looking at the success of a vaccine in a clinical trial. But the more important immunity is called T-cell immunity. This is a specific type of immunological cell that provides more longer-term immunity. And so for those of you in this audience, you probably had chickenpox when you were a kid, and you did fine, you recovered. And you probably had children who had chickenpox, but you didn't get chickenpox when your kids got chickenpox. Well, the reason is because T-cell immunity is that your immune cells have these T-cells that remembers that this infection. And so when it's reintroduced, it prevents you from being reinfected. So vaccines are generally, as a rule, prevent the severity or prevent the infection to occur. It is generally not, one of the actions is not to prevent the transmission of a virus, despite what you're hearing in all of these vaccines that trying to promote vaccine mandates, vaccine passports.
Is that your understanding, that vaccines do not prevent transmission?
No. I thought if you get vaccinated, you can't kill grandma anymore. That's what the politicians have been saying all along.
And what
Dr. Fauci, too.
And what Dr. Moy says is there's no data to support that these COVID vaccines prevent transmission. So thinking about that, and to his point about passports and vaccine passports and the like, then what's the way out vis-a-vis these lockdowners? If it's understood that vaccines don't prevent transmission, then how do we get out other than people being infected and recovering? Because there's been rare cases, a small number of cases where people have been vaccinated have been infected.
I know somebody that happened to.
Right. It's a very small percentage. But the point is, and then the vaccine essentially prevents it from being particularly severe.
Right.
For the most part, if you're not having an adverse reaction to the vaccine. But think about that. So what's the point of the vaccine? I know it's to protect yourself. I get that. But that's not what's being sold. What's being sold is it's a panacea to get us back to pre-pandemic America or some approximation of it. Except those same lockdowners say we have to eliminate the transmission of COVID. So now
we cannot eradicate COVID.
I know.
I know that.
So now where are we? Where are we going
to
be?
There's no incentive to get vaccinated.
I mean, there's incentive to get vaccinated to protect yourself, potentially.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Moy, on the best path to immunity.
So the question is, well, what strategy offers the best long-term and broad protection with T-cell immunity against the current COVID vaccine, COVID infection, and future strains that may arise? Well, there's no question. Hands down, it's
natural recovery from this infection. You will never beat what Mother Nature can do. Never. The next vaccine would be an attenuated live vaccine, because attenuated live vaccine would give you those three different immunity, respiratory, humoral, and T-cell. Problem is that of the majority of the 150-plus vaccines that are in development around the globe, probably less than 3% of them are working on an attenuated live vaccine.
So, again, in terms of protection, attenuated live vaccine, then there's the killed vaccine, and then there's the subunit vaccine, like vaccination levels in terms of efficacy is what he's arguing, trying to translate right. this in layman's terms. All the vaccines are virtually all of them, the ones out and the ones in development, are subunit, the least powerful. And one of the things he explains is that Operation Warp Speed, they made the decision to go for the subunit because it's the easiest to get to, the quickest. The attenuated live vaccine level, that type of vaccine, it takes more time, requires more clinical trials. We don't have time. But it also means that because we're at the subunit level, that the booster shot, it's why it takes two jabs, why they're talking about an annual booster shot. And it also is more susceptible to being pierced by mutations. So where are we at? He pointed out a couple of other things just with respect to the vaccines, and this is consistent with what I was describing him saying. The vaccines do not provide any respiratory mucosal immunity, which would be the requirement to ensure reduction in the viral load during transmission. Do not provide. The animal studies with Moderna showed that the primates still had viral particles in their respiratory tract, which would support the previous statement he made that I just referenced, that they do not provide respiratory mucosal immunity. So for those people who've been infected with COVID and recovered, they would have respiratory mucosal immunity. And he's comfortable saying that those individuals would not be transmitting the virus, but only those individuals. So what does he say about the vaccines? Who shouldn't get them?
Oh, I want to hear this.
He's pretty squeamish about just about everybody getting them. Like, anybody healthy and under 50? No.
And so if you've also been infected with COVID, my advice would be don't take the vaccine. It's not necessary. And there's potential risks if you did. The subunit vaccines, the most common, most have narrow protection. They're short term and they're susceptible if the S protein mutates. There's no scientific evidence that the COVID vaccine will prevent transmission. They don't predict transmission because they don't provide respiratory mucosal immunity. There's no test or confirmation test in the clinical trial that showed it prevented transmission. And there's actual animal data showing that these vaccines, the animals are still showing viral particles in their respiratory tract. So I feel that the vaccine should not be treated as a one-size-fits-all. So if you're under 18, you are a part of the lowest risk group. There's rare chances of transmission, rare chances of dying. You're going to recover almost 100%. Here the risks are worse than the benefits. I do not recommend vaccinating children. I don't think that it should be a prerequisite for children to get vaccinated to go to school. If you're pregnant, there clearly is an increased risk of having a more serious case of COVID. But the neutralizing antibodies from the vaccine do not cross the placenta maternal barrier. So there is some difficulty, unlike influenza, there is some difficulty getting that fetal protection from the vaccine, and we don't have enough safety data on these vaccines in animal models of pregnancy to know what effect they may have on the fetus. And so hydroxychloroquine, which has been around for 50 years, has had track record in pregnancy. It's safe. The drug crosses the placental-maternal barrier quite easily. So for pregnant women, my recommendation would be not to be vaccinated. And if you get infected, talk to your doctor about hydroxychloroquine. What about under 50, healthy, no risk factors? I think the long-term risks are undefined, and so they outweigh the benefits. So I do not recommend vaccinating people under 50 in that category. What about under 50 and you have risk factors? In that situation, I think if you don't have access to the hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, then you could consider the vaccine for medical reasons.
What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. I appreciate what he said about this is not one size fits all, because everybody has a different physiology, different health profile, different station in life, both in terms of age, pregnancy, these sorts of things. But it's that's a big statement. One, that the virus doesn't prevent transmission. I mean, the vaccine, excuse me, doesn't prevent transmission of the virus. And two, you're healthy under 50. He's basically saying no. The risk is greater than the benefit. We'll be talking to other medical professionals about this the rest of this week. You can be sure. So stay tuned for that. We'll have this discussion. We'll hash it out. Jordan in Antioch, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. So we're finally getting to the point where we talked about the gentleman yesterday or that article about the quote-unquote anti-vaxxers, and we're following the science, and we tend to lean more towards actual literature and actual study, and here we are, right?
Right.
We're right back to where we started. Now, a lot of us, including myself, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. My wife is vaccinated. She's a risk. It's her choice. It's my choice. It's your choice.
Yep.
But I don't trust the vaccine. And I don't trust the vaccine because I think it's going to kill me. I don't trust the vaccine because I have a president who's shoving it down my throat while he's wearing a mask. That makes me nervous. That automatically makes me pull back. Then you get a study like this, just like you have countless studies on the ineffectiveness of masks. So I don't wear one of those because I know there's no point. Now, you can get this. I'm on my way to work. I can email you, try to find all the information, email you. But, Dan, you're a smart guy. You could go home today, and before you get two fingers of four roses down, you can find this information out there. Fauci is a carpetbagger. He's a bag man. He's a bureaucrat. He's not a doctor. He is the head of the NIH. Guess who owns the patent for SARS and COVID-19? The NIH in Wuhan. Guess who got shut down by the quote-unquote swamp-draining Trump administration? Fauci, but he never did. In fact, it's going to grow. His organization at the NIH with the virology and the development of that is going to grow 1.5 times over the next 5 years. These are the people that go into the caves, they find these viruses, they bring them back, they study them, they try to replicate them, they try to make them stronger, and then they try to figure out a way to cure it. This man, I don't trust this man. He is going to end up coming back to him as knowing a whole lot more than he ever did.
Thanks. Go ahead, Jordan.
But there's a lot out there. Just look. You'll find it.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. Appreciate it.
Why Trump didn't fire him, I'll never understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's
bringing more voices earlier.
Bringing more voices, for sure. You know, it's one of those things. It's Comey, Fauci, these institutional creatures.
I thought he was going to drain the swamp.
You know, it just takes a bit of a review of his 4 decades there to say, boy, this guy's awfully political. And other people picked up on it, too. I mean, we played the Nobel laureate that torched him back in the 90s. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning, guys. I'll tell you, this is that you brought this up is really interesting because, real quickly, the whole vaccine raised a bunch of questions in the church about ethical demline and research, stuff like that. So I was like dinking around, looking around. I found these guys at JP2. They're actually out in Iowa, Amy, your way. And I looked at their stuff, and I thought Dr. Moy, I had a couple questions, so I emailed them. Dr. Moy responded back to me.
Wow.
I thought that was fantastic in an email. Full disclosure, I do support their cause. Basically, the key with them is they're developing technologies with the live attenuated virus, and it's going to take time, right? And their hope is they can't market it. They have to sell it to somebody. I mean, you can find more on their website. But the interesting thing is, and the thing that always bothered me is, these two big companies and Johnson & Johnson have a strong footprint in the market now. How easy is it going to be for somebody to buy this brand of virus and come out and market it? And because at one point, Dr. Fauci said, AstraZeneca, I don't know. We already have vaccines here that are doing the job, so maybe we don't need somebody else in the market.
Yeah. But yeah.
I'll tell you, these guys are really good. These guys are really good. And you know what? It's nice to talk to a human being, even if it's through an email. They make you feel as if you have station in their world, and you can ask them. If we had more of this going with our experts, something that you've done with your overnight show when you had it with Dr. Lee out in England, and all those people that you introduced, and if we can sit down and have a talk with everybody in full disclosure and be truthful and true professionals, it would be great. But we can't do that because it's being perverted by political reasons, in my opinion. I think this is really a disaster in our trust in the medical system. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Critical race theory indoctrination in the schools. That was the topic that Martha McCallum tried to tackle with the American Federation of Teachers boss, Randy Weingarten.
She's also a social studies teacher, folks.
Yeah, we heard all about her being a social studies teacher and a history teacher.
Yeah. She cares about the kids.
McCallum did a pretty good job. Not letting Randy Weingarten get away with her ham-handed pivot to the 2020 election. This is really something to behold. But listen to the response from Weingarten as she tries to dance around having to take a position on this race hustle in the schools and everywhere else.
I'm a history teacher and I'm a social studies teacher. And I believe we should teach history. And from everything I can see and understand from the data I see, 1619 was the year that the first slave boat came from Africa to the
Correct.
United States. So that's a point in history that I think we should be teaching.
But that's very simplistic, take on it. I mean, the 1619 Project teaches that's the true beginning and the founding of our nation, not 1776, and that the reason for the revolution and the colonization was because colonists wanted to preserve slavery, that the country was founded on the basis of wanting to preserve slavery. But that is not factual. That is not true. In fact, scholars in this area say there's no evidence that colonists were motivated by that in coming to the United States. So it would be wrong as a historian to want to teach them something that is not true, because that's the basis that sets up all these other tenets that lead to teaching kids that we live in a systemically racist country.
So I would actually say that I've had several conversations with Nicole Hannah-Jones, and I have not arrived at the same conclusion from her work as you have. But let's put it this way.
Well, that's not my conclusion. That's directly from their work. But go ahead.
I would hope that Fox would be just as focused on let's get rid of the misinformation about what happened in this election. This election was free.
Oh, come on, Randy. Come on. This is not the topic that we're here to talk about. I'm not going to talk about that. We've talked about that before, but that's a dodge, okay? Because children in this country, we rank 36th in math. okay? That's about midway of all the developed nations in this country.
Yeah. She said it. She called her out. She put it right between her eyes and said, that's a dodge.
Well,
I love it.
Obviously it was, and it was.
She didn't have an answer.
So painful. I guess Randy Weingarten thought she was being smooth there. I mean, it's so tone deaf. But there's something that she did that's worth pointing out about this on this topic and so many others. This is what the left always does. And I'm not talking about the ham-handed pivot. That's obvious. The Mott and Bailey. The Mott and Bailey routine that they do, where they stake out a moderate position so they can advance an extreme position. So you hear what she did. The 1619 Project. Well, look, as I understand it, all the 1619 Project is about is saying that 1619 is the year in which the first slave ship came from Africa and landed in America, Virginia. That's it. That is true. And so that's the moderate position. That's a 1619 Project. That's what it is. Just saying 1619. In 1619, this happened. What is the big deal? Now, all your white kids are racists. So the 1619 Project is just about this historical fact. It's not about their completely erroneous description of the Revolutionary War and the founding of this country, that it was to protect slavery, which has been repudiated by historians and scholars throughout academia, mainly on the left. It's not about a race hustle to enrich Nicole Hannah Jones and to advance the political agenda of Marxists in the black community, Marxists on the New York Times editorial board, and Marxists everywhere.
Right. I mean, we should be teaching that no race or sex is inherently superior to any other race or sex.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, just understand what they do. Just this historical fact. What's the big deal? Meanwhile, boom, the whole race hustle. That's how they do it on every issue. Take note of the technique so you can call it out when you see it, because you'll have those in your circles of influence do the same thing. It's only this little thing. No, it's not. No, it's not. You're going to tell me this little thing, which I'll concede historical facts, and so we're going to excuse this big thing, this moderate factual thing, and then this extremist thing. Nice try. We're here to talk about the extremist thing.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
So after McCallum called her out on the dodge, then she went back at her on some of the specifics of this extremist thing called the 1619 Project and critical race theory education indoctrination.
So I am asking you, and you say you're a social studies teacher, do you favor teaching students that 1619 is more important than 1776? Do you favor that?
I favor us teaching about 1776, which I have often done. Mm-hmm. I favor us teaching about 1619. I also favor us teaching about the Holocaust and the genocide in terms of the Holocaust.
Absolutely. I learned about all those things in school that you just mentioned. But the problem, do you think that it's wrong to suggest to children that if they're white, they belong to an oppressor class? If they're black, they belong to a victim class? Do you have any problem with that?
I think we should be lifting up all ethnicities. I don't think we should say that one is an oppressor class and one is a non-oppressor class. I am a big believer in celebrating diversity, in actually looking at and helping look at people's lived experience.
It's complete doublespeak. Randy Weingarten is completely on board with the 1619 Project and the race hustlers, completely. And the tells, despite what she said after she equivocated, is when you say, I'm for diversity. You're not for diversity? It's another Mott and Bailey. Do you support diversity? Yes, I support it. I know it exists. I don't need to do anything about it. It just exists in the natural world. I have no problem with it. Well, then you need to embrace Black Lives Matter. No, I don't. One has nothing to do with the other. One is a feint for the other. That's what she did again. And the lived experience That is another phrase, like we talked about with Professor Frank Ferrutti yesterday about survivor. I'm forever a survivor of something.
Like a cancer survivor or a COVID survivor.
Which becomes the thing that defines you and you never let go of and you never really get past. Lived experience. That's just a sanitized version of saying my truth. That's what that is. I think it's very important that we recognize people's lived experience. It's interesting, maybe. Is that the basis on which we define things as objectively true or false? No. Lived experience. My truth is what that is. There's this book I've mentioned before, Liar's Poker, Mary Carr, who's an English professor at Syracuse. And she had a great riff in there about having to really learn that just because something popped into her head, her lived experience, didn't make it true. She had to bump up what she was thinking about anything to things that exist outside her, truth that exists outside her. Randy Weingarten and these hustlers, they don't do that. And they don't want you to do that. And they don't want your kids to do that. And that's what they're teaching them. Mike on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Then Randy Weingarten threw out the Marxist dog whistle. She did not mention the Armenian Holocaust, the White Russian Holocaust, or the Chinese National Holocaust. She only mentioned the Jewish Holocaust. And that's a dog whistle. We got to knock down Christianity. The Marxists know if they get rid of Christianity, they could destroy the culture of the country. And they could start over with a blank slate.
Well, thanks for the call, Mike. I think her Holocaust, and I think we should teach the Holocaust. There's another Mott and Bailey. You think we should teach the Holocaust, don't you? Yes. Well, what? So we should teach the race hustle, too. No. No. One does not support the other. But that's always what they do. Something very innocuous, uncontroversial. Let's agree on that. And then let's agree on the extreme piece of my agenda, which is what I'm really talking about. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, tell me if I'm wrong, but that ship that they refer to, the first slave ship, was that not a slave ship that was heading to Jamaica? And due to a storm, wrecked, and that's how it ended up on the shores of mainland United States? And if that's the case, then their whole premise for the 1619 Project is a lie. I mean, just not that anything else isn't, but I'm saying it wasn't even coming here.
Yeah.
It was going to Jamaica.
No, actually, slavery was already a part of the U.S. history before then, before 1619, actually. Thanks for the call, Marvin. I mean, they have the ship landing in colonial Virginia as sort of the watershed moment, and then they use that to define the nation from 1619 forward. I just want to get to something else on this topic. There's a study that working paper, really, that a couple of Yale researchers recently did. Zaid Jilani writes about this. And they've done this for a long time, and they basically a bunch of policy proposals, and they run the policy proposals through a race and class frame. In other words, they take an issue like $15 minimum wage, and they say, do you support it, regardless of any mention of race or class? Do you support if it would promote racial equity? Or do you support it if it would benefit a specific class? Okay, so it's trying to see what persuades. Class works is more effective than race or race plus class when you do both. But the interesting thing about this is that the race appeal and the class appeal are just as effective for black voters as white. I mean, they're similarly effective. By that I mean to say the race frame. Do you support this policy to promote racial equity? that it would help black people, for example. The racial frame doesn't work because it's exclusionary. If I'm not black, then what benefit do I get? That's part of it. The other part of it is it just runs afoul of sort of people's innate sense of fairness, at least in America. And so the interesting thing is the race frame had no advantage over the class frame for black Americans in the survey. The only group that was slightly receptive to the race framing, the only group.
What?
White Democrats. Of course.
Of course.
Of course. And
they're the ones who hold ethnic groups down. Well, people that are very smart and intelligent. Oh, black people don't know where the DMV is. They don't know how to use the internet. They can't figure out how to vote. It's appalling.
No, they're condescending. That's exactly right. John McWhorter's point. By the way, we have him on the show tomorrow. You want to tune in for that?
Oh, good. I'll be here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just thought,
I know you'll be here tuning in. Everybody else, too. Yes, I mean, the condescending nature of the champagne socialist left, these terrible, hate has no home here, white leftists. Worst people in the world. And Zaid Jilani, I think, properly summarizes this research, which was a bit surprising to these Yale researchers, that the race frame had no more appeal to blacks than whites, with the exception of white leftists. He writes, my guess is that the progressive movement is simply captured by an upper class elite for whom anti-racism is now an all-dominating philosophy. Sure, it may not persuade your average voter, white or black or anyone else, to support your political party, to frame every message in terms of race, but it probably does impress your social cohort. There's a reason elite prep schools are now embracing critical race theory, while most working class communities and public schools would find some of its tenets esoteric and unrelatable. It speaks to how out of touch these people are. Right. Yes, that speaks to it, and their treatment of minorities as mascots is despicable. It speaks to how out of touch, how craven, how disreputable, really, those people are. Terry in Rogers Park, here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I was wondering, is critical race theory to the great whites also taught in England, Germany, and France?
I doubt it.
Thanks for the call, Terry.
Don't know for sure.
Well, certainly, to some extent it is, yeah. I mean, it's there's a different spin on it because it's not about the institution of slavery in America so much, but it certainly is about the oppression of minority groups, the history of slavery in Europe. I mean, there's these race hustlers throughout the West. It's not limited to America. Tim in Woodstock.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, Randy Weingarten says that this is being misinterpreted. That's the whole idea of it. It is a misinterpretation of history. It's exactly what it's meant to do. It's not meant to teach facts. It's meant to sway the way people think, particularly about their ancestors. And there'll probably be no pushback, as far as I know, from Black Lives Matter against Randy Weingarten for saying that.
No, they know she's on board. Course, yeah.
Yeah, she's on board. She knows the game. And, you know, Dan and Amy, you had a police officer, you know, a few police officers on their audio yesterday on the show. And the one police officer, you know, and God bless him, he had like 20 years of service and he was speaking some true things, but they always have to put in that little qualifier that we understand the anger because of, you know, the way blacks have been treated by police through the years. And it's like you show me where what you're talking about. There's 15 unarmed shootings last year unarmed blacks rather by police. And you want to say that this is systemic racism? So, you know, it's like why can't I walk through your neighborhood without worry of being hurt? You know, what can somebody explain that to me? You know, you people want reparations. Why can't I walk through your neighborhood without fear of being hurt? But you can walk through mine and you'll be fine.
All right, thanks, Tim.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, with Mother's Day just passing. I'm sorry, Birthing People's Day.
Birth? What? Oh, boy, by the way, where are my cards or flowers? Did John Cass take those when he filled in for me on Friday?
Men can get pregnant, too, now. It's Birthing People's Day.
Oh,
so
okay,
it's not exclusive
so, yeah.
To you.
Oh.
That running concurrent with our birth rate in America at a 40-year low. This piece of the New York Times. Now, this woman is a bit of a sniveling leftist, but it's an interesting piece nonetheless. Her name is Elizabeth Bruning. I became a mother at 25, and I'm not sorry I didn't wait. I became a mother at 25, and I'm not sorry I didn't wait. Sort of tackles the women can have it all argument. It tackles the financial wherewithal question that people have before they have kids. Millennial women in the United States waiting longer than any generation in recorded history to have children, and that's a trend that's raised the rate of births among 30-somethings to a 50-year high, even though overall births are down, as I mentioned. Higher education, of course, correlates with delayed birth. 2012 Pew survey found 62% of women with a high school diploma had given birth by the age of 25. Only 18% of women with master's degrees or higher had done the same. Well, I guess you can't have it all. At least not at the same time. That's the real key. Having it all at the same time. She writes, on the money front, hesitant parents to be are exactly right. I would know. My husband and I were never in abject poverty, but we understood what it meant to be precariously employed at the start of our careers. When I was 25 years old and 20 weeks pregnant, the magazine I wrote for was abruptly put up for sale. The attractive maternity leave policy listed in our contracts included. I wound up interviewing for a series of new jobs wearing an oversized blazer, hoping nobody would detect that I was applying for two. No career comes without risk, but early career precarity and minimal savings certainly raise the stakes of having kids in one's 20s, so that's a reasonable concern. Sure. Okay. Yeah. It was interesting, though, what she describes at this cocktail party that she and her husband went to, where those were the parents of her daughter's classmates. He recounted a sly line after the party of questioning spun by a partygoer he thought was aimed at determining how, given our ages, we could afford the ritzy preschool that our daughter attended with their daughter.
That's so rude.
She was trying to figure out if it's a welfare thing or a scholarship thing, he chuckled.
That's true. It's a real thing, folks.
It was the former. It was a scholarship thing for them. But she writes, families living inside D.C., which we did at the time, are entitled to free preschool. Those living in the suburbs outside the district have to pay tuition. The fact that our little girl could spend a few hours a day learning and playing on Mayor Muriel Bowser's dime was the best part of living in the mildewy two-bedroom condo we owned, and it certainly made being young parents in a major city considerably easier. Yeah. Oh, you mean school choice? Scholarship programs? Interesting. But what about that? What about becoming a – I'd like to hear from moms or birthing people.
Birthing moms.
Who became moms at a young age, and whether or not in retrospect you would have delayed. What's your reaction to the delaying trend that is
happening?
Predominant, yeah, with young couples, young women now, not to mention the not intact family trend. But you were relatively young.
33.
Yeah, okay. All right. So
and then 34. I just had them back to back and got it done. But that was old. I mean, click, clock, tick, tock goes the clock, you know?
Yeah, so that was. And so you were like at the tip of the spear in terms of the delayed. But this, well, in terms of like the delaying, the pushing it off until you're 30.
Well, I was married to my career first, and then I decided to get married and then have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do it any other way. I wanted to.
Well, that's
that order.
Yeah, that is. I think
yes. Thank you. The prudent thing to do.
Thank you,
Grandma Ginia. Thank you.
Yeah, the better approach. Yes. But
my mom, she was married and had a baby by 20.
Yeah, I mean, it's
back then it was you know you
totally
go to
different.
College and get your MRS degree. That's what they called it.
our parents' generation and the World War II generation before them completely different.
Oh, yeah. And my grandma got married at 26, which was almost scandalous back then because she waited so long.
Yeah. Yeah. This is how Elizabeth Brunig describes it. Describes having the baby and so why she doesn't, you know, think about the having waited longer, doesn't have any recriminations about being a mother at 25, which, yeah, I mean, actually, frankly, that seems very young today, but it in historical terms, it's not that young. It's sort of center cut. One of the things they don't tell you about having babies is that you don't ever have a baby. You have your baby, which is to you.
It's our baby.
The sum of all babies.
I'm not pregnant. We're pregnant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dan's favorite. Besides love is patient and love is kind.
Love that too.
Reddit, yeah. Weddings.
She writes, what I didn't understand was that deserting yourself for another person really is a relief. My days began to unfold according to her kid's schedule. That weird rhythm of newborns, the worries entertained were better than the ones that came before, more concrete, more vital, less tethered to the claustrophobic confines of my own skull. For this member of a generation family famously beset by anxiety, it was a welcome liberation, actually, to have a child. So that's a bit counterintuitive. And it's, I think that's a pretty healthy outlook, too, because even though she leans left with some of her bloviations about government policy to underwrite raising a family. Government never raised family, never will, young lady. Never raised a child, never will. She goes opposite the left's approach to human beings as liabilities rather than assets. And I don't mean to be casting this in financial terms, but this is a burden. Having a child's a burden. Oh, it's hard work, yes, but it's also
rewarding.
Liberating,
yep.
Is what she's saying.
Yeah. And I think a lot of young ladies aren't having kids because of the environment. Seriously.
Because the world's going to end?
Yeah. And also, you know, that's just clogging the landfill. My niece's friends, clogging the landfill with more diapers, and it's a waste of energy and the needed supplies that we have. Like, what has gotten into you? I mean, people are brainwashed by government policies that they put into place. Global warming is not going to kill anybody.
The idea that climatological predictions are the basis on which you make a decision about having a family.
But people are doing it, Dan.
Well,
it's crazy.
People are doing all kinds of silly things. But I agree. I know that that's true. And, you know, you have the hysterics like AOC to thank in part for that. But I don't know.
Yeah, so, do your part for the world and don't procreate.
Well, what's your opinion on or your reaction to Brunig? Like, you would be the opposite, I guess, question, which is, are you sorry you did wait a little bit more? Or would you have rather had children younger and had more children, had a full shoe, you know, a shoe
like,
full of them?
Like a litter of children?
Yeah, like 10 or 12.
Yeah, so they could work the farmland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't regret it.
I thought the timing was perfect. I wasn't ready to have kids. But when I was ready, I got to it right away. Like, boom.
And
33 isn't too. But I got a text message already. People saying, Amy, 33 is not old to have babies.
Well, I mean, it's.
Because a lot of people are in their 40s that are having kids.
Well, I know that's old too. But I mean, it's just relatively speaking, we're just talking about the changes over the last 70 years. I mean, they're significant in terms of age. And also, I mean, there's more risks associated and all those things.
Right. But there's more, you know. Testing and
things
to do to protect the placenta and the baby.
Well, it's just interesting because this woman who definitely leans left, I became a mother at 25, young mother. I'm not sorry I didn't wait. And
she probably has more energy to play with her kids.
Yeah.
Those 70-year-old men that are having babies, what?
Well, they're doing a Tony Randall.
Oh, right. That's right.
Have a kid then kick it.
Yeah.
You're out. I'm out. Done. I'll leave the checkbook. Good luck.
Yeah, have a good time with that. It's only for the rest of your life.
What about only two?
That's all I could handle at the time.
Maybe adopt. Adopt a few now.
No, I don't.
No,
think so.
You're done?
No, I'm done.
Is it Peyton and Eli? That's going to be it?
Yeah. 312-642-5600. Oh, look who's on the line.
Chuck and Delavan. Oh. You're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, how you doing? My girlfriend took the COVID test. I don't believe in COVID tests, but she got the two shots. They said that some women now, even in their 70s, they're starting to produce eggs because they got the COVID shot. And my girlfriend's 67. I'm 65. So I told her last weekend, I said, what if I could slip one past the goalie? She said, there's no way. So now she's cutting me off. Now she's cutting me off. See you later.
Thanks for that, Chuck. Yeah. I don't really want to think about Chuck from Delvin, Wisconsin, slipping one past the goalie.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so Tiny Dancer, former mayor of the city of Chicago, he has been tapped by President Biden to be the U.S. ambassador to Japan. He finally got something.
Yay!
And, you know, Japan is a very polite, very courteous nation, and so they want to welcome the U.S. ambassador to be, and this is how they receive the news.
Okay. The worst she knows, the truth she has. Everyone broke out in karaoke. Oh, I feel so real. Is that you?
No, no. Two Japanese singers.
Oh, and Kobe. Yeah.
It's going to be all the rage in the karaoke parlors, no question about it.
How does one go from a majoring in ballet to ambassador to Japan? Mm.
The only man who ever went to Sarah Lawrence College, Tiny Dancer. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yesterday, two Israeli women killed in the southern city of Ashkelon by a rocket that landed on a home. Hamas boasted that it had fired 137 rockets at Israel in the space of 5 minutes, bringing the total up to more than 400 from the previous night, wounding more than 70 Israelis. The Israeli military, in response, striking Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorist sites, these rocket launch pits, IAF, the Air Force, sending 80 aircraft to destroy those pits in Gaza. And this attack on Israel was generated this response from Bolshevik Bernie Sanders. I'm extremely concerned by the growing conflict in Israel and Palestine. Once again, we see how the irresponsible actions of government-allied right-wing extremists in Jerusalem can escalate quickly into devastating war. Government-allied right-wing extremists in Jerusalem, their actions are responsible for the fighting. Well, that's a positive pleasantry compared to what Rashida Tlaib, socialist Spice Girl MF-er Spice, you recall, what she had to say on MSNBC.
I mean, this is an apartheid system. I mean, Israel's own prominent human rights organization, B'Tselem, has declared it. Human Rights Watch has declared it. And Palestinians on the ground have been telling us for decades that they've been, their homes have been demolished, that they've been targeted, that violence has been met by Israeli-led forces under Netanyahu's racist policies. What we're really telling Palestinians fighting apartheid is the same thing being told to my fellow Black Americans across our country here, and that are fighting against police brutality. There is no form of acceptable resistance to state violence, except for the denial of people's human dignity. And we need to stop. We need to stop and look at the fact that our own country is enabling it, with billions of dollars every year being issued to Israel, even though they are promoting racism and dehumanization? Why not say to Netanyahu currently, who is, you know, running on anti-Arab rhetoric consistently, accepting violence by allowing Israeli police and military forces to side with Israeli citizens who are literally throwing, physically throwing people out of their homes? U.S. taxpayer dollars should not be used to commit human rights violations. That needs to be said. I have yet to hear anybody from the Biden administration declare that, that our money will not be used to degrade, to dehumanize, and to kill or evict people out of their homes.
Mm-hmm. Biden's been silent on this. Silent on the gas shortage, too.
Rashida Tlaib's comments, Israel is an apartheid system. I mean, it's not anything you haven't heard from her before, I suppose. And I don't know. I don't know if the Democrat Socialist Party wants to take judicial notice of those sorts of statements. I don't know if the Anti-Defamation League would like to weigh in on this. Rashida Tlaib, she wants to defund the police here, and she wants to defund Israel's military in the Middle East. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Aviv Ezra, Israel's Consul General to the Midwest. Aviv, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
What about Rashida Tlaib's comments about the apartheid state that Israel is overseeing, and the and her implication, as well as Bernie Sanders' implication, that it was Israeli Benjamin Netanyahu and his right wing extremists that initiated this fighting?
I don't think it exactly meets the reality on the ground. I mean, there is no form of tolerance that we could have ever to a murderous regime. Any support that is given to a murderous regime that shoots 1,000 rockets today, by the way, the number is 1,000 rockets in less than 48 hours on innocent civilians, that bring death to Israelis, that bring hundreds of injured, puts millions in shelters, and commits human rights violations against not only Israeli civilians, but rather also against Palestinian civilians, because what they're doing is that they're committing double war crime. They're shooting at innocent civilians of my fellow country citizens in Israel, but they're also making sure to do it from innocent civilians' locations within the Palestinian area. So to know that if we have to respond, God forbid, we will have to hurt also innocent civilians. So we're talking about a double war crime on the murderous regime called Hamas. And you're talking about a organization that is shooting 1,000 rockets on civilians. And I will just put this out there in the most blunt way. What would America do if not 1,000 rockets would lie or would rain on your heads, but 100 or 10 or even one single rocket? What would America do
in a case like that? Yeah. And you've got an air defense system that helps shoot down some of those rockets while they're in flight. But
Goodness they have the Iron Dome.
So the Palestinian Minister of Health says 43 Palestinians have been killed, including 13 children. Who fired first and why?
Well, first of all, the numbers are from the Hamas Ministry of Health, so I don't know how credible they are. Second, as I said, because they're committing double war crime, out of the 40-something, 43 people that they're mentioning, the majority of them are either Hamas operative, which means terrorist, or Islamic Jihad. Now, at the end of the day, if they are going to be committing that double war crime and shooting from their innocent civilians, like schools or like hospitals, there will be a response on behalf of the Israeli Defense Force. And this goes back to our right for self-defense. Again, as we discussed it, like you said, if there will be one rocket rain upon you, or upon the European Union, or upon Michigan certain district in Michigan, that congresswoman will retaliate and will respond in self-defense, and rightly so. And we are doing the same.
Well, it's sort of a remarkable thing to hear from Bernie Sanders, Rashida Tlaib, even though it may not be new. Still, it never ceases to be remarkable. It is worth just noting that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are still terrorist organizations as so designated by our State Department, including the State Department of the Biden administration, designated terrorist organizations. So you have Democrat Socialist members of Congress running interference for listed terrorist organizations.
100%. And by the way, the Hamas charter is a document that calls specifically for the murders of Jews and for the annihilation of my country. So there should not be any mistake and any vagueness in understanding who are the bad guys and who are the good guys, and standing with the forces of democracy, with the forces of freedom, is pretty clear if you stand with Israel in its right for self-defense.
You know, the previous administration made such great progress along with Israel in trying to promote peace in the region vis-a-vis the Abraham Accords. I wonder where that stands right now from your perspective, these pacts that Israel was signing with Muslim countries.
Such a great question, because we were totally focused. The entire foreign policy of Israel was focused in building bridges. And we were, because of the previous administration's effort vis-a-vis the Abraham Accord, we were successful in building additional bridges on top of Jordan and on top of Egypt and now Bahrain and the UAE and Morocco, to show you that it's possible when you have a moderate partner on the other side. However, when we are talking about Hamas, we are talking about a radical, murderous regime that took control of the entire area over there in the Gaza Strip. And while we were focusing on building these bridges with these moderate forces in the Arab world successfully, they were focused on R&D and not finding solutions to COVID, but R&D of how to create better missiles to kill more Jews and more Israelis. So there's no partnering, and there's no negotiation, no discussion with, as you said, a designated internationally designated terrorist organization like Hamas. They have to understand that there's a price tag attached to killing innocent people, and we will extract it from them. There's no doubt in my mind.
And what is your reaction to the response or lack thereof from the Biden administration so far on this, as well as your sense of their perspective on continuing to build upon the work that was done by Israel and the United States under the Trump administration?
Look, I think that, as you mentioned, the Trump administration has pushed very, very strongly in favor of moving the peace wagon towards the right direction, and worked perfectly. And with the Biden administration, our foreign minister just talked a couple of hours ago with Secretary Blinken, and Secretary Blinken very specifically stated that Israel has the right for self-defense, especially when we have thousands of rockets like that raining upon our head. And you know, we expect our friends, both here in the United States, but also in the U.S. Security Council and also in other junctions around the world, to stand by Israel, because Israel is not just fighting our war against the radicals. Israel's fight against the radicals is representative of the fight of the entire like-minded countries against radicals around the world.
I loved David Harsanyi over at National Review, his tweet in response to the Bernie Sanders statement I read at the outset. Israel has all the right enemies. It's so true. So true. And hopefully it still has some of the right friends, too, and starting with the United States and the Biden administration. We'll see. Aviv Ezra, Israel's Consul General to the Midwest. Aviv, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
So, legendary Blackhawks broadcaster Pat Foley was compelled to apologize for something.
Okay, yeah, I'll listen to what he said and see if you're offended first. This is during Monday night's Blackhawks game.
It was a brutal year in terms of the travel and the condensed schedule and the way these guys were able to handle themselves and get through it without having a game to be rescheduled because of them. I really admire that. I admire their commitment to following the rules and the protocols. I do know this, partner. Had I been traveling with this team this year, I might have put a bullet in my head. I mean, I wouldn't have even had access to the player lounge that they had. So for somebody like you or I, it would be room or hockey rink. That's it. You couldn't leave your room if you weren't at the rink. So really admire the way these guys were able to get through it under very
trying
conditions.
Yeah, you know, so the headline is Chicago Blackhawks announcer apologizes for shocking bullet in my head reference to describe NHL's COVID restrictions. So people on social media, once they heard
while
that,
while he's complimenting the players for abiding those restrictions,
yeah, and that they didn't have one COVID positive case. So here comes
on social media. God, there's another phrase that needs to be stripped from the English language.
Well, here's the apology.
And the puck escaped, and just as he was crossing the line, so that will lead to a stoppage. Hey, partner, I need to throw something out here. When I was talking about complimenting the Blackhawks and the restrictions they had to deal with on the road, I made a comment about myself and how hard it would be for me to deal with all the restrictions.
Don't do it,
Pat. And I said, put a bullet in my head. I wish I didn't say that. Oh. I'm sorry if I offended some folks. Apparently I did. And so I apologize.
It's indicative of the culture that we've created.
Offending the hoi polloi on social media. Oh, the horror.
Luckily, he didn't lose his job.
Being insensitive to the suicidal, like me, I'm getting suicidal with stories like this. Am I being offensive to anybody? I don't care.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And don't you find it a bit ironic that the same people who say incentives don't matter when it comes to the currently unemployed and loving it say, hey, we need to pay premium wages for teachers, for government employees to attract talent.
Oh.
So incentives matter for some people, but they don't matter for other people. It's amazing how the government commissars know just who responds to incentives and who doesn't. It's remarkable. So, for example, to my point, a good write-up from our friend James Freeman, Best of the Web at the Journal. Ralph Smith covers pay and benefits for federal employees at a website called fedsmith.com. It's worth checking out. The median pay, average. The average pay for a federal employee, 2.2 million of them, excluding benefits. What do you think it is?
Average pay.
Federal employee, 2.2 million federal employees. The average pay excluding benefits. So, you know, when you hear this number, throw another 40% in terms of benefit market value onto it.
I'd say $52,000.
Right. $90,510.
I wasn't even close. $90,000? Mm-hmm. That's the average?
Average.
Without benefits?
Not including benefits. The
average. Where do I sign up?
The average salary in the United States in 2020, $56,000.
Oh, okay.
Now, there is the point, and Freeman makes it, that theoretically we pay lawyers and other highly credentialed public servants to use their expertise in ways that ostensibly enhance our lives, although I don't know about enhancing our lives in federal government. I don't know if those two phrases belong in the same sentence. But even with that, and even with the fact that federal workers tend to be older and more educated, we're still overpaying. When you start controlling for those variables, as the Congressional Budget Office did, the federal government paid 17% more in total compensation than it would have if average compensation had been comparable with that in the private sector after accounting for the characteristics of workers and sort of the job classification, which has been the way it's been for some time. It's the same in the state of Illinois, by the way. So, I mean, you know, in the private sector, would you like a 17% salary increase? And 17%, is that a lot? 17% of what you're making now, is that a lot? Is that a big difference? I think it's a big difference. Comparable employees in federal government versus the private sector. 17% difference. And overall, 90,000 versus 50,000 and 56,000. And, of course, this doesn't account for the other aspect that we've talked about before, too, which is the revolving door. And a lot of these highly credentialed professionals that go to work for a stint in the federal government are using that as the way to build cachet to go make real money turning around and petitioning the government or helping companies get government bennies when they're on the other side, the private sector, of course. And that tends to be those lawyers and other skilled professionals. But the incentives matter to them. Teachers can't pay teachers enough.
Oh, no. They're our heroes. Kidding.
But they don't work for money. But we have to write blank checks to the Chicago Teachers Union and every other teachers union. Incentives matter for some and not for others. Incentives matter for those in the favored constituency groups, government, not so much for those living off the government. Isn't that interesting? I think so. And again, I know this $300 a week unemployment benefit bump from the federal government on top of what is previously provided by federal and state combined. I know that doesn't matter, according to both Biden and Jen Psaki. I know there's no evidence that that's keeping people at home, except there is. But then you got to ask, too, we mentioned the survey on Friday. Why is the NFIB lying to us? Strong job growth continued for small businesses in April, according to NFIB's chief economist, Bill Dunkelberg, pretty well respected. And yet 44% of all owners reported job openings they could not fill in the current period, which was up 2 points from March. Unfilled job openings continued to mount as April, the third consecutive month, setting a record high reading of unfilled job openings. We're now at a record high of 8.5 million overall. April's reading is 22 points higher than the 48-year historical average of 22%, double in April, NFIB's read on unfilled job openings that companies are looking to fill. Gosh, double the 48-year average for April. What would account for that? Huh. What would account for that? What's different this April than in previous Aprils over the last half century? John in Portage Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I'd like to know if the people at NPR, and I will listen to NPR if I need a nap in the afternoon, if they make 17%.
Oh, we lost John.
Or did you hang up?
No, I didn't hang up on him. Sorry, John, we lost you there. But if NPR makes 17% more than, than us?
Probably.
It probably make more than 17% more.
Tax dollars don't put our salaries.
Yeah, it's nice when your business gets subsidized by everybody, isn't it? Certainly cushions that bottom line sensitivity. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Well, sorry to be a couple of minutes late. I was just trying to go quickly through this inflation report that just came out. And, inflation is here, folks. It's back big time. It's rearing its ugly head. The month number was, I think, 0.8, 0.9, which is a lot of inflation. That we're at 4% over the year, 4.2%. I mean, these are big numbers. How predictable was this? These people don't even understand economics 100, that inflation is too many dollars chasing too few goods. We're dropping trillions of dollars out of helicopters, and I'm wondering, gee, why are prices rising?
No, I hear you. I wonder, though, if you think that as we reopen over the course of the next few months, some of that, I mean, you can't eliminate all of it because of all the funny money that was printed, as you just said, but some of that inflationary pressure will recede when there are more people producing more stuff.
Yeah, except the problem, we've got a dual problem, Dan, which is that, we got a lousy jobs report, too.
Yeah.
So, right, how many job openings there are in America today?
8.5 million.
Right, I think the number is 8.2. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's an all-time record number. And by the way, there are 650,000 construction and manufacturing jobs open today. And yet in the last jobs report, we lost 50,000 workers in construction and manufacturing. We've got the most idiotic policy in Washington right now. We're dumping money out of helicopters, giving all these people free money. We're paying people not to work.
And then we're wondering, gee, why are food prices, why are gas prices, why are lumber prices, why are prices at the hardware store and the pump and the grocery store going up? It's so obvious. It was so predictable. I mean, I'm angry at the stupidity of the Biden administration, of the Fed. It's like these people have their heads. I'm not going to tell you where I think they are.
But Stephen, White House economist said there's no measurable evidence that the $300 federal unemployment bonus is discouraging unemployed people from seeking work.
Is that unbelievable or what? I mean, it's so laughable. And look, even the White House economists who are half sane know that that's not true. And all you have to do is just go out anywhere in the country outside of the Washington bubble and just ask anybody who runs a restaurant or a store or a construction site or a factory and ask them, can you get your workers back? No. Why? Because their Uncle Sam is paying them, in some cases, 30 or 40% more. In other words, you can get X if you go back on the job, or you can get X plus 20% if you stay home. I mean, this is not complicated. And they're so screwing it up. All we have to do right now is get the government out of the way. Meanwhile, by the way, they have another $2 trillion spending bill they want to spend. And I hope if anything good comes out of this bad inflation number we got today, it would be insane. It would be malpractice for government to spend $2 trillion more money on top of the inflation we've already got.
Well, we were talking about this before you joined us, numbers on federal, the average salary for federal employees, the 2.2 million federal employees versus what the average salary in the private sector is.
Yeah, so what is your estimate for how much higher those federal workers are making?
Oh, it's shocking.
Well, CBO's estimate is 17%.
17. And that, by the way, does that include the benefits?
Yeah, I think that I think it's just salary with the CBO estimate.
There's one other thing, huge benefit that they don't take account of,
right?
Because I know a lot of people work at what I call Club Fed, and these are federal employees. By the way, federal employees haven't been working for a year. I mean, they've been working 10 or 15 hours a week. They're getting full-time paychecks because the government has been closed down essentially for the last year.
Yeah, that sounds
right. And the other thing that these federal employees have that none of us in the private sector have is basically lifetime job tenure. You cannot fire a federal employee. I mean, it's almost impossible.
Why would you want to?
I don't know. Dan, do you have tenure?
No, I have a contract that is voidable as soon as I commit an act of moral turpitude. Yes.
Yes.
Well, I mean, but to the point, I mean, it's funny because what we've heard from, this is amazing statements from people about this, the lies that you have to tell or the ignorance you have to display to try and run cover for terrible public policy. You know, if you can't get employees, then just raise your wages. And if you can't raise your wages and stay in business, then you got a problem with your business model. So the government comes in and changes your cost structure, and then you have a problem with your business model.
And, you know, that's exactly right. And so that's when I asked some of the people at the White House, you know, why are you doing this? These small business employers can, like, for example, if you own people own like some McDonald's or Burger King franchise or, you know, In-N-Out Burger or, you know, these hamburger or Popeyes, you know, those stores, they make maybe, if they're really profitable, they make maybe $75,000, $80,000 a year on a high cost, you know, so their margins, you know, their profit margins are so small. So these dimwits from Washington, they you can absorb these higher costs. We're going to, you know, increase their minimum wage. You're going to have to pay your workers more. You're going to have all these extra costs. And they're like, no, you're going to put me out of business.
Well, hey, because,
you know, here's my problem. Joe Biden hasn't had a job in 40 years. He, not only has he not owned a business, he never even worked for a business. So why would anybody think someone like Joe Biden, why would we put someone like that in charge of the economy? And these, you know, they got these sociologists running the Council of Economic Advisors who know nothing about the economy. Why don't we put real life people in? I take the guy who runs Joe Hardware Store over, you know, some of these people in Washington in terms of what's going on with our economy.
Well,
that's how clueless they are.
I just got to say, you know, hey, those people that can't find employees or the businesses are struggling, look, you should have either learned to code or gone into making windmills. I mean, that's your fault, right? Everybody needs to be in the green energy business,
Yeah, if you make windmills, you're going to make a lot of money because we're going to spend, you know, we're going to spend trillions of dollars on new Solyndra. Remember Solyndra, by the way? We're going to have scores of Solyndras. If these, you know, give all these money to these windmill factories and the solar plants, and half of them will go bankrupt, and then Uncle Sam will pay the tab. And, of course, that means you and me.
Just like we have Americans making $56,000 subsidizing Teslas for federal workers making 90. I love it. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's time for a revolt, folks. By the way, I was out in Elmhurst last night, and we had a really great turnout for a Freedom Works thing. I think there were about 500 people there. It was awesome, and everybody was saying, "I listen to Dan and Amy every day, and you guys are like rock stars."
Mm. Well, we'll open for you sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, I'm opening next week, May 20th. We're going to be. I'm doing Woo-hoo! A one-on-one interview with Steve Moore. He's going to be back in
town. That's going to be fun.
All right, Steve.
Yeah, I wish it were Amy. I wish Amy were doing it.
Yeah, me too.
I'll be parking cars out front, so maybe, you know, tip me well, okay?
Yeah, she'll have the first audience question. Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, see you next week.
Okay, see you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy talk about big love. See this story? The world's most prolific dad, a guy named Meshek Neandoro from Zimbabwe, has 151 children from 16 wives.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
And he's getting busy with it, huh?
And he's,
do you think he regrets having children so late in life?
He sleeps with four of his 16 wives every night.
Ew.
And he is getting ready for his 17th wife. He's 66 years old, has no plans to retire.
How many?
The great ones never know when to quit.
151 children?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
He's never going to be able to retire. That's a lot of mouths to feed, huh? I thought two were bad.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the Conservative Party in New York has a mayoral candidate. It's not just all about Andrew Yang. His name is Bill Pepitone. He's a former New York City police officer, and he's the nephew of a former Yankee great, Moose Scowron, of course.
Oh.
Obviously, Joe Pepitone.
Joe Pepitone.
He's the...
who also played for the Cubs in the 70s.
He did, yes. I'm sure he... like most former Cubs, would like to forget that part of his career.
I like Moose
Focus
Cowan.
On the Yankees.
Moose Cowan was a nice guy.
Bill Pepitone is the mayoral candidate's name, and he joins us now. Bill, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. How's everybody doing today?
Good morning. So you retire from the NYPD, and now you want to take up trying to run that city. Why?
Well, because it's my city. It's the city I grew up in. It's the city my family raised me. It's the city I served for 20 years as a New York City police officer. And a city I can't sit back and watch be completely destroyed by politicians who just don't care, who aren't leaders, who don't care about the city and don't care about its people. You know, I reached a breaking point last summer, like many of us did, when I watched the greatest city in the world, some of the most expensive commercial real estate in the world be burned and looted, and leadership do absolutely nothing, just stand by and watch them. I reached a point where I had to do something, and I decided to run for mayor and try to effect some change.
And crime in New York City is up, what, 54% than it was a year ago?
Crime has skyrocketed. Our shootings have skyrocketed. Homicides have skyrocketed. And it's all because of the weak policies that this mayor has put into place and the lack of support from Albany and our governor.
And also, too, I mean, because we have the same thing here in Chicago, as you well know. It's not just the mayor. It's also the prosecutor. And you've had a problem with the prosecutors in Manhattan, just like we've had one in Cook County.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems we have, though. Besides our political leaders, our district attorneys aren't prosecuting crimes. They're not prosecuting low-level offenses. They're not prosecuting violent crimes. It's a revolving door of justice. We saw during the riots last summer here in New York City, and I'm sure you had the same issues over in Chicago, where police officers were locking people up during the riots, and 3-4 hours later, they were back out throwing bottles and rocks and trying to run police officers over. There's no way a city can survive like that.
I'm still astounded by the statement that de Blasio's wife made a few weeks back, where she said of the violence on the streets of New York City, you know, if you see a fight or if you see somebody being attacked, then, you know, you should intervene. So now the Bernie Gens vigilantism is the order of the day in New York City, according to the mayor's wife.
And the disturbing thing is not just the mayor's wife. We had the Brooklyn Borough president, who's actually a mayoral candidate right now. Last summer, during all the violence, we had a rash of illegal fireworks activities, dangerous fireworks activities. And the Brooklyn Borough president, who is now a mayoral candidate, told his constituents not to call 911 for fear of a heavy-handed police response, instead to confront them themselves. And we had a young woman in Brooklyn who followed her elected official's advice, walked up to somebody who was shooting off illegal fireworks, told them to stop. She was then shot 8 times and killed. This is the leadership we have in New York City right now.
What do you think is the absolute worst thing Bill de Blasio has done?
The worst thing he has done is divide the people of New York City. Last year, during the riots and the violence, instead of coming out strongly and condemning it, instead of standing up for the people of every community, he stood in the streets and spray-painted slogans in the middle of the street as if that was going to end the violence, as if that was going to end the racial problems we have here in the city and all the tensions that were going on in the city. All it did was exacerbate things and divide people more and more. He's been a divisive, quote-unquote, leader from day one, and the faster we get him out of City Hall, the better we'll be.
I just looking at this field, there's a lot of candidates, and I love this story about two of them, a former Citigroup executive named Ray McGuire and a former HUD secretary, Sean Donovan. They were asked what the, approximately what the median sales price for a home or apartment in Brooklyn is.
What'd they say?
And apparently the two of them have not paid attention to what's happened in Brooklyn since Gabe Kaplan was playing Mr. Carter on Welcome Back, Carter, because they guessed $80,000 to $100,000.
For a house in Brooklyn?
It's like the median price is like $900,000. Of course it is.
Yeah. They're only off by about $800,000.
I mean, how out of touch are you for that? No, that's
a Citigroup executive, a financial services professional, and a former HUD secretary. It's wild. I mean, it seems like New York has largely the same problem Chicago does, which is just an unbelievable. The odds are astronomical that you could put together so many bad political leaders in one city or state. That's what we have in Chicago and Illinois. Seems to be what you have largely in New York City and state, too.
Without question. And again, I mean, they were only off by $800,000. That's not really that bad. Anybody can make an $800,000 mistake. We have quite a cast of characters running for mayor here. Not a leader amongst them. And you know, my city, your city out in Chicago, we have to change things. The only way we can do it is through voting and putting different people, putting leaders instead of these type of politicians in office. We have to make a change. We have to do it now before it's too late.
So the election and all these candidates running around, New York City has had Republican mayors before. Rudy Giuliani obviously comes to mind. And I wonder if because of the field is so big and it's mostly Democrats and Democrat socialists, the play is as sort of the consensus Republican conservative candidate, you can shoot the gap and get to a runoff and potentially win this thing if it's a one-on-one.
Well, that's what we're hoping for. We're hoping for the primarily Democratic city, our residents here in the city, to reach a point where they're fed up, where they've seen enough crime, where they've seen our education collapse, our education system collapse, our economy collapse under Democratic leadership.
for the last 7+ years. We're hoping they walk away from the old practice of just voting down party line. We need a change. This city needs a change. And, you know, when you see four-year-old children being shot in Times Square, if that doesn't open your eyes and make you just look back at your political stance and wonder, you know, what do we have to do different? When you see a child shot in the middle of Times Square in the middle of the day, it's got to change your mind and say we have to do something different.
Do you feel like there is something bubbling below the surface in New York City? I mean, part of the problem is, like in Chicago, is you've just had so many people leave and so many people who know better and want better leave. And so it's this rather ironic situation where I'm just describing Chicago. You tell me if this is consistent with New York, where the worse they make it, the better it gets for them, because right-thinking people just pull up stakes and take off.
It is similar. We've had a lot of people who can leave, have left. But what we do have is a lot of people who simply can't leave. People with city jobs, people whose wives or husbands work city jobs, children who are in school and they don't want to uproot them. People don't want to leave. People have a genuine love for New York, and I'm sure it's the same in Chicago. They don't want to feel like they're being forced out, and they want to stand and fight. Is there something bubbling underneath the surface? Yes, without question. It's about to come to the surface in this November's election. Again, we have a lot of good people who are, this is their last stand. They're going to fight for their homes, fight for their jobs, fight for their city one last time. And if we don't win, if we don't change the course of New York City, the city is going to be unrecognizable in 2 years.
So if you become mayor, how are you going to draw people back into the city? I saw what Bill de Blasio was doing. You know, go to a show on Broadway and you'll get a free vaccination shot. Thinking that, or come in for a baseball game and you'll get a free shot.
How about eliminate the city income tax for starters?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways we can bring people back, and we could do it quickly, and not by offering vaccination shots or baseball tickets. First things first, it's got to be about public safety. Without public safety, we have nothing. We don't have safe streets. We don't have safe subways or transportation. We don't have safe schools. So we have to rebuild the New York City Police Department, rebuild their morale, and start proactive policing once again. We have to open up our businesses, fully open them up safely, but fully open them up, and start eliminating some of the regulations that are strangling our business owners. Our tax code is crushing businesses in many, many different industries. New York City has not been open for business for quite a long time. We have to open up for business. We have to protect our investors and their investments. And if we do that, we can turn it around and do it quickly.
On the public safety side, I mean, it seems to me perhaps an opportunity is just to run on broken windows. We're bringing broken windows back.
Without question. That's one of the main points of my public safety platform. As a police officer in the 90s here in New York City, I participated in the broken windows approach to policing under Mayor Giuliani. And it worked. It turned the city around. We had previously set records for homicides under Mayor David Dinkins just a couple of years earlier. And when Mayor Giuliani came in and implemented the broken windows policing, where you address low-level offenses that act as a gateway to more violent crimes, it turned the city around. And it brought tourism back. That's what we're severely lacking right now. We're not getting any kind of tourism, because people are afraid to come into the city. And when you see four-year-olds being shot in Times Square, like we had a few days ago, that's another blow to our tourism. Without tourism, our economy tanks and New York City's finished.
Have they caught that guy yet?
I don't believe they have. They know who he is. They have his picture. Oh, yeah. Our detectives will find him within hours, I would imagine.
And if you can, before you go, can you just settle this this running dispute for us? Does he or does he not, I'm talking about Andrew Cuomo, wear nipple rings? Is that, I mean, does he, do we know this? I assume this is hotly debated in New York City.
You know, it was a topic of conversation for a short time.
Dan won't let it go.
I'm not letting it go. Yeah.
He just won't.
Unfortunately for him, the allegations about the nursing home death and the sexual harassment allegations kind of veered the story away from his alleged nipple rings onto more serious issues. So yeah. I believe Governor Cuomo wishes they were talking about his nipple rings right now.
I'm sure.
Well, maybe he can write another book about
handling a pandemic.
His fashion,
such leadership,
fashion statements. All right, Bill Pepitone, where do people get more information about your candidacy? You might as well support a conservative retired cop in New York City running for mayor. We don't have any people running for mayor in this city, so get involved in New York. Where can people get more info about you?
Sure, they can go right to my website, Bill Pepitone for NYCmayor.com. More information is available on Facebook. I have a Facebook page, Bill Pepitone for NYC Mayor. Twitter, at Pepitone for NYC. We're posting every day, putting info out every day. My platform, my vision for New York City, we're all right there on the website. So I appreciate any support. And anybody that has any questions can reach out to me at any time.
Bill Pepitone, former New York City police officer, nephew of former Yankee great Joe Pepitone, and Republican candidate for mayor of New York City. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck.
Thank you both. Appreciate it. Stay safe.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, got a text. Didn't Joe Pepitone also play first base for the Cubs? Again,
in the 70s,
I don't recognize the Cubs as a major league team. So
that's
why
don't.
I reference the Yankees.
Okay.
I don't consider
them David Ross's new squeezes.
I don't consider them a professional baseball team. No, I don't. Who is it?
Some actress I've never heard of.
Well, that's great. Right. That's
you know what that is? That's called exciting radio.
Right? Yeah, no, that is.
No, here, no, I'll fix it up. Right? No, David Ross. He's.
I don't care. I wonder if he met her on Dominion Dating, because you know I'm a bit of a matchmaker. I like to bring people together.
Is it our time?
No, Dominion Dating. It's a new site for Christians, and it's a pretty aggressive. It goes after soy boys and feminists. I kind of like it. I like the attitude. Take a listen.
Of course, I eventually want to end up there.
As opposed to Hell's Bells.
Yeah. Video?
Yeah. Our generation is lost and lonely, barren and bitter. The Bible says it's not good for man to be alone. We're created by God for divine purpose, to be fruitful and multiply and take dominion.
I'm Brandon Durham, founder of Dominion Dating. Our goal is to create the best network of Christian singles in the world.
We believe in pursuing marriage locally. However, with so many Christians confused on marriage, many singles must look beyond for a godly spouse. Conventional dating sites fail to deliver. Dominion Dating is dramatically different. We go the distance to connect godly singles.
Yeah.
All right.
I just want to get the Dominion Dating soundtrack. I don't know how to use the site. I just want the soundtrack. But for godly Christian singles there.
That's good.
There's a site, you know, so you don't have to. You can get off Farmers Only and
Farmers
Our
Only
Time
and Our Time and
whatever else is out there.
Bimber, Tumblr, Rumbler.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If you're the head of the Centers for Control and you lose Senator Susan Collins, you're in a bad way. And that's what Dr. Rochelle Walensky was in yesterday on the Hill amid this barrage from the normally genteel, deferential Susan Collins.
So here we have unnecessary barriers to reopening schools, exaggerating the risks of outdoor transmission, and unworkable restrictions on summer camps. Why does this matter? It matters because it undermines public confidence in your recommendations. in the recommendations that do make sense, in the recommendations that Americans should be following. I'd like you to respond to why the CDC is not following the standard procedures, why it's having offline secret negotiations with one stakeholder that was revealed only through reporting and a FOIA request, why it is exaggerating outdoor transmission. We know that masks make a big difference indoors. They don't outdoors.
Thank you for that question. Maybe if I could take each of your examples one by one. First, the school guidance. As a matter of practice, the CDC engages with stakeholders, with consumers who take our guidance, who use our guidance before it is finalized, so we can understand whether it addresses their needs.
Can't. Just can't from Walensky. But I would say that the state of affairs is a little bit worse for the Centers for Control than Susan Collins described it as. People losing confidence in your guidelines. I think at least for half the country, we're well past losing confidence. We're at the point now
where it's criminal, don't you think?
Well, we're at the point now, in my view, where when they promulgate guidelines, I treat them like a punchline. They're a joke, like those summer camp guidelines that Susan Collins referenced. It's not undermining confidence. It's outright dismissal. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by John Gabriel, editor-in-chief at Ricochet.com, contributor to AZCentral.com as well. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
Your neighbors in Arizona, they hanging on every guideline that is put forward by the CDC these days?
No, it's kind of odd to hear the recommendations because, much like Florida, we've been pretty much open the whole time, never had a mask mandate and so forth. And I feel like I'm reading news from March of last year. It's like, I'm not sure. It reminds me of when we didn't exactly know what this virus was. And, okay, let's be overly cautious and make sure that we're avoiding people as much as possible to bend the curve for 2 weeks, as we were promised at the time. And now it's just so out of touch. It doesn't make any sense at all. Anything the CDC says, kind of like you both agree, everybody just rolls their eyes and goes about their lives.
It's like we're living in two different Americas, though. If you're in Utah or Florida, you know, the mask mandates are off. They don't even have to wear them at school anymore. But yet here in Chicago and New York and California, I mean, we're still in it. And I don't see an exit ramp anytime soon. But how do you think the CDC will ever get their reputation back? Because I'm pretty much through with them.
It is going to be very tough for them to do it because it just seems like they really enjoy their, you know, guest spots on CNN and MSNBC and being on the cover of Time and things like that. They care about that and not about getting this country back to work or even the virus for that matter.
You know, it's CDC is going the way of the FBI and the CIA, at least to half the country, maybe more for some, perhaps some different reasons. But where do you see, you know, when you have that sort of institutional legitimacy evaporate, I mean, evaporate among a wide swath of the population, where does that take our country, generally speaking? I mean, doesn't it just lead to more of a crack up than we're already having in terms of what sort of Amy was referencing, free states and not so free states?
I really think it does. Just the lack of faith in institutions. Gallup always polls once a year about Americans' faith in institutions, and they just anything involving big government, especially D.C., just drops and drops and drops year after year. And this is a prime example why. It just seems like they've ignored the limited number of things that they're supposed to be involved with, and they're so distracted by trying to bring about some kind of utopia on Earth that they can't even get the little things right. You know, one of the basic functions of government is dealing with something like this, like back in the Spanish flu days 100 years ago, is dealing with these major pandemics that cross state lines, that cross national lines, and hey, let's have a unified response. But the agency, like so many others, have been so politicized. People have great problems even trusting them, and they just try to find out the answers for themselves. And that's why you'll have some people go into more bizarre conspiracy theories, but other people just trying to figure it out on their own like all of us have had to do. You know, it's like, this just doesn't make sense. Let me read up on what they're doing in other countries, and maybe I can find out what the latest science says about this stuff, because it's very difficult to trust what's coming out of D.C., which is very alarming when it comes to something as serious as a pandemic.
A local issue for you that is, of course, national in implication is that audit going on in Maricopa County. And I wonder if you can give us a handle on what, if anything, you can anticipate coming out of that audit at this juncture.
Yeah, well, some of the people who have actually started, who had actually voted for and called for this audit, are starting to get second thoughts about it, because it seems like the people in charge on the ground there are kind of following rabbit trails and not really allowing as much press access or just observer access as a lot of people would like. I was skeptical about the vote totals, the way they were coming in on election night, but after talking with many people, you know, from both parties, people who lean to the left and the right, I was quickly reassured that it's like, okay, this seems like it's legitimate what they're doing. I don't have a problem in theory with the audit, but it's one of those things where the audit has to be really bulletproof if you want to make a statement, you know, regardless of what they find. If they find that, nope, Biden actually won, or, you know what, we think a few votes were left on the side here. You just have to be very transparent and above board about these things. And it's kind of been done in a somewhat shady manner, which is the problem with vote counts in November, is a lot of people are just like, boy, we weren't allowed to observe this as much as we wanted to. And I just think they had to be very high on the ethics and above board. I don't see it changing a lot. It wouldn't actually change the votes. They were just trying to say, hey, there might have been a problem here. We need to tighten up election integrity. But I don't see a lot changing from it. They're going very, very slowly, far slower than the original vote count. That's another thing that's concerning. One good thing is the governor just signed legislation to pass the House and Senate, and legislation for election integrity, which for some reason Joe Biden hasn't called Jim Crow quite yet. So that's a positive. I think everything these days that one Democrat doesn't like is called Jim Crow all of a sudden. But it's just common sense, rational security of our elections. Things and both parties should be endorsing that.
Things like not allowing people to come back and, quote unquote, cure their ballot after the fact.
Exactly. Exactly. All these just goofy things. And some of these, which were changes just for 2020 because of coronavirus, there's no reason to continue those. That was a special circumstance. And if that's all the Democrats, when they change these rules, is all they cared about was election integrity, they should have no problem rolling back these kind of excessive problems that they've had with dropping off ballots and, you know, all these kind of odd practices. It was supposed to be a once-in-a-lifetime type solution to address an odd situation of a pandemic, but there's no reason to carry those things forward. I just really hope that nationwide, more and more states pass common sense things like voter ID. There's nothing wrong with it. This is not Jim Crow. This is common sense, because every illegal vote cancels out the vote of a legal voter, and that's unacceptable in a democracy.
Let me ask you one other thing about Maricopa County, because it's something I heard and I reported on our show with the appropriate qualifications. But somebody that's pretty close to this that I trust, he's, you know, professional, he understands the administration of elections and so forth, suggested that one of the issues may be the way that adjudication of questionable votes was done. And what he's suggesting, and this was also apparently from talking to some election authorities there, is that one of the things the Dominion system allowed for was batch adjudication, because, you know, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of ballots in Maricopa County, so to do it faster. And it may have been the case, not that anybody was saying, just adjudicate them all for Biden or adjudicate them all for Trump, but when you chose to do batch adjudication, it defaulted to a ballot position. And there were a number of ballots, and don't really have a handle on how many, but there were 214,000 overall, this was the number I was told, that were adjudicated. And there were a number of those ballots where, upon individual inspection, it was more obvious that the vote should have been for Trump than for Biden. But upon batch adjudication, they went for Biden. And there's some subset of that overall universe that could be problematic. And it's painstaking to go through and make those determinations. I just wonder, something like that, that's a bit technical, but, and it's not, you know, conspiratorial, but it's a legitimate question of sort of the system, the setup of the system. If you've heard anything like that, that could potentially come out in this audit and prompt more discussion and perhaps more reforms in terms of the actual hardware and the processes of adjudicating ballots.
Yeah, that is the type of question that I really hope the audit does delve into and find out. You know, if nothing else, a sampling of those kind of ballots that were automatically, you know, batch adjudicated, those are the kind of things that concern me, because the vote was so close here. You know, it really was a toss-up, and just, you know, a very small number of votes processed incorrectly might have changed the result. So I haven't heard any details on that, but that's one of the kind of fact-finding things I'm really looking for in this audit. And the audit also, in and of itself, it's kind of concerning that it's so controversial among Democrats, because if they won, they shouldn't be worried. So right. a lot of the complaints about it, I think it will still hold up that, you know, they counted overall, they counted correctly, and Biden won. But the panic among so many local Democrats is rather bizarre to watch, and it shows an insecurity in their position, which shouldn't be there if they think everything was fair and above board.
Hey, one other question. This is particularly important to Chicago because so many Chicagoans flee here for Scottsdale, Maricopa County, and Arizona generally. So what's the deal with that dramatic income tax increase that was passed, jumping up that I think the top rate to 8% or 8.5% in Arizona? There was some talk that that was going to be challenged, because that certainly makes Arizona a less attractive place to be if you make over, I think it was $200,000.
Yeah, one thing, it is tied up in the courts. One thing that immediately happened is the Goldwater Institute, a state-based limited government think tank here I actually used to work at many years ago, they have challenged it because they say voters cannot just on the fly approve new taxes. They have an extremely strong case because the state constitution says it needs to go through the state house. Not just some voter initiative pulling on heartstrings or whatever. It needs to be the politicians need to be able to weigh in on it, and they were not allowed to in this case. So I think they have a very strong case, but as you know, these things take a long time to go through court. But I think it's going to be hung up in the courts for quite a while and hopefully reversed, because, you know, in my understanding, it certainly seems like an unconstitutional effort that they waged there.
John Gabriel, editor-in-chief at Ricochet, ricochet.com, contributor to azcentral.com as well. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Got some bad news for you, Dan.
Yeah.
You can't hang out with former First Lady and Chicagoan Michelle Obama.
Stunning. She's beautiful, though I don't really have any interest in hanging out with her.
Well, she was on CBS This Morning, and she told the interviewer that she will not allow anyone to be around her or her family unless they're vaccinated. Quote, you want to hang out with us? You get your vaccine, she said.
Tell you what, another great reason not to get the vaccine.
Get all of it. Finish it up, and then we can talk. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Stunning. Just gorgeous.
I think she's beautiful.
Oh, no
I
question.
Do. Okay.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.